Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hello, hello.
Hey, Jordan.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm tired. I came back from Egypt a couple days ago and I hit the ground running with the chairmanship stuff, and I've just been emailing and doing and running ever since. But it's good. It was worth it to go.
Yeah, so you were recently in Egypt. I guess you go to Egypt pretty frequently, but were there anything new going on, new things to see, anything newly opened or?
There's always something new in Egypt because the current government is always making changes in Egypt. So, but I didn't spend much time in Cairo. Indeed, I was there for one day. We had an overnight at the Manor House and then we moved along. So I didn't see much Cairene activity. Got in, got out, went to the Egyptian Museum, fought the traffic that one time, and then we went to the airport and left.
Okay.
So Cairo is where I think things are changing the most. And then we traveled down through Middle Egypt onto Luxor.
That's cool.
Then we got to Esna, got on a Dahabeya, and then went on down to Aswan.
So it you was saw a whole... the conservation at Esna?
I didn't actually. Ah! And I was super upset, but Esna is right beyond the lock, and that's okay. Where you get the boats. It's the easiest place to get the Dahabeya. And I'm like, who wants to go to Esna Temple? And we had just been to like four temples.
A bunch of temples,
yeah. Yeah. And everyone was like, we're just getting on the boat. And so, we saw a lot of temples. So I have not gotten to see the Esna astrological ceiling, but you know, there is time. It will happen. It will happen. But I did get to spend a lot of time with the Dendera astrological ceiling, cool. Which is insanely beautiful and really wonderful. And, you know, you get a crick in your neck trying to figure out where the different zodiac signs are, which are the decans, how it works. I love it. I love it. So,
Well, so speaking that was great. I know, you know, we just had the eclipse across most of the U.S. And I think the next one goes like right through Luxor in like 20 something. People are already like, oh, we should go.
Yeah. I talked to hoteliers about this and they are already booked up at many of the hotels. So if you are planning this journey during the eclipse, I would book now rather than later. Yeah. And a lot of people do have their rooms booked. I don't think I'm going to go during the eclipse, but if you're going to go to any place during an eclipse, I think this is a good one.
I just don't want the crowds, but yeah, it'd be cool, I'm sure.
Yeah. If any place can handle it, it'll be someplace like Luxor, which is used to having massive crowds descend. Also, the way Luxor works is the government and other entities have shut down a lot of independent travel through a variety of mechanisms, some formal, some informal. And so the people in Luxor will be those with a room, and it may be fully booked, but they should have all of the food and water that they need, as opposed to descending on some sad place in Ohio or whatever, in the middle of nowhere where you might not. So they'll be prepared there.
Yeah. No, it should be fun. Jeff's dad was like, should we go? And I was like, no, I do not want to be a part of that. I was like, you go. Just send me pictures.
And a lot of people have made bookings and I'm like, yeah, I think I'm going to just stay home for this eclipse and not make a big thing out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, no, I don't want those crowds.
But because remember, I was part of the 2017 eclipse for CNN.
Yes, I remember watching you on TV in the helicopter.
I know. And they flew me to South Carolina and they asked me how much I weighed before I got in the helicopter. I'm like, no one said this would be an invasive journey of insecurities and horror show. But anyway, I was in a helicopter during the eclipse. And it was crazy how dark it got.
Yeah.
It was just insane. It was also crazy how much the helicopterist, is that a word, had to practice our takeoff and landing. So I was like, oh, I've only been in a helicopter one time. And then I was in a helicopter 18 times. So
have you done this before?
This is not your first time. We just wanted to get, he wanted to get his route, and CNN wanted to get his route right, and they wanted me in it, and they so it was fine. But yeah, so that was cool, and I have experienced it. And I shall let others do the
weirdly,
same.
I feel like being in Southern California, we've had a bunch of like partial.
Yeah.
So at least weirdly, since I've been here, we've just been in the trajectory of a bunch. But yeah, I mean, they're cool to see. I always like think about, oh, in the past, like a lot of cultures view them as something negative, and just it would have been really scary just for it to go dark all of a sudden and have that,
Oh
happen.
no,
So.
we can only imagine what it must have been like in the ancient world when people were like, what the hell is happening, and where is the source of our light gone? And even if you had astrologers slash astronomers, because in the ancient world there's really very little difference, who are able to predict that this was going to happen, still everybody in the fields or everybody working in life, I mean, it would have been a crazy time. So
All right, well, cool. Well, the other thing you've been doing, I mean, you've been so busy. You got back from Egypt and then like the next day left to go to our annual conference, the RC.
Yeah, here's what I did.
Annual conference.
I flew back to Los Angeles to see my son, whom I couldn't see because he had fallen asleep from some gig that he was doing because he's an excellent drummer. And so I had 10 hours in LA. I repacked my bag. And then the next morning I got on a flight to Pittsburgh through Denver with Amber. And we had a lovely RC conference. American Research Center in Egypt meets every year, twice on the East Coast, usually, and then once on the West Coast. And we presented papers, and I went to many papers, and it was a very, very busy conference. So yeah, my voice is also gone, which people
can hear it
probably
a little bit,
hear. Yeah, because I've done nothing but talk for the last 3 weeks.
Well, and your poor jet lag also. I'm sure your body is probably like, I don't even know what time zone I'm in.
Actually, I'm not jet lagged at all. And I wasn't even really jet lagged in Egypt because there's no time for jet lagged. And when there's no time, you just do it. When you're busy, you just go.
You're one of like the only people, like if I'm tired, life is not happening. But you are one of the people who can like function.
I can
I don't
power
know, maybe
through.
It's like being a mom or something. You guys just learn to roll with not having sleep, I think, maybe.
That too. Not having slept for, good couple years at a time, you're like, I can do this. I can function.
Yeah. I'm just, if I'm sleepy, like, not happening.
I think that's great. I don't think motherhood is great for one's health.
Well,
I really don't. But
I just read this really interesting, I'm not going to get too off topic, but I read this really interesting book on menstruation, like the system of menstruation and periods.
Yeah,
and it was very fascinating, and like what it does to your body, how it works, and how like actual magical it is. But that's like
and how exhausting it is,
exhausting, and but just also like what organ can have a open wound but also heal with no scar tissue.
Yeah,
it's actually quite. And they're using menstrual blood and extracting the enzymes and the healing properties of it. And they're using it to heal wounds because it's actually
really,
yes, the properties of it. We have an open wound, don't get infections, and it heals without scar tissue. It's actually rather insane.
I do believe we could find some Egyptian prescriptions, medical prescriptions with menstrual blood in them, or blood. And then it's implied that it would be a menstrual blood. And that there is the iron and the other. I don't want to freak people out if one is ingesting it, but these things, for people who know about
people eat placentas,
exactly,
umbilical cords,
that it has a nutritional element to it, and that mammals do it all the time, but humans think too much. But yes,
so actually, looking at one of our Q&A listeners, we're doing a Q&A for April. One of our Q&A questions actually deals with this, so maybe I can just pivot very smoothly to talking about female reproductive
let's
organs.
Do that. It wasn't a smooth pivot. I said motherhood is not good for health. You went right to it, but that's okay. Let's just pivot more.
Let's pivot. Okay, so Matt asks or comments that recently on Jimmy Kimmel, he has shown conclusively that men do not know female anatomy. And this has been like on TikTok where people ask men like,
and more than like, they don't know where the clitoris is.
Yes.
More than
just like that trope, but just like, they don't even know like how periods work, like how many, where do you stick the tampon? They think it's like in your ureter or something they don't realize. Like, or just like you ask them how many tampons do menstruating people need, and they're like, I don't know, like one, and it's, they're just totally not involved in it. Frequently misidentifying the uterus, vagina, vulva, and other organs, which I think, people use vagina, I think, as like a collective term for everything when it's not, that's not obviously
Because it's
accurate.
the because the vagina is only the
Inside.
tube, the inside tube, the
Yeah, I think
muscle
most
tube,
cases
and
we're
the
talking about vulva, but I feel like that's not a commonly used
and what
phrase.
is visible on the outside is the vulva. And yes, and yes. I'm waiting for Egypt,
Yes,
Jordan. You know
okay.
I could talk
So,
about this all day, but I'm
yes,
waiting for the
here's
Egypt
the
element
Egypt.
just.
So this would call into question English translations of Egyptian texts that
Oh,
use
yeah.
female anatomical vocabulary, for example, what we translate as womb. But would the original Egyptian writer use the correct word in the first place, given their unusual knowledge of human anatomy? Do you think the male writers, most likely in this case for these texts, would correctly identify female organs? How detailed was the understanding of anatomy to those who dealt with the dead who bled, having bled into the general or scribal population? So, how much did this anatomy that maybe the doctors or priests who were doing the mummification, maybe they had a very intimate knowledge of these things, but did the general population, the scribal population, understand it?
This is such an interesting question, and it's a question I think that can only come from a place of modernism, in which we have disassociated ourselves from our bodies to such an extent that we don't even know what organs are there. And anybody who's living in the ancient world or on a fucking farm would know what these organs are because they're dealing with it on the daily. And only in a modern society, a postmodern society in which the body has melted into an Instagram filter, would we be confused about, these different terms? And I would add to that that we would ask this question from a Judeo-Christian Islamic perspective as well, because you've assigned a moral ambivalence at best and a moral problem at worst to knowing the female genitalia and which part is which. So we just pretend these things aren't there. But so the questioner, what's the name of the questioner?
Matt.
Matt is absolutely correct that we should be worried about lexicography. That's what you call it, this practice of trying to figure out what an ancient word was, what it was referring to, and discussing, oh, there's this ancient word and there's that ancient word. And all of us have to deal with lexicography. You have to deal with it for your linen studies, right? So you have to deal with,
No good answer.
and it's horrible. Like, do you have clear answers for spindle whorls and looms and different kinds of thread?
Yeah.
And you don't have a word for S spin, right?
No.
There's no such thing. Do you have
And
a
just
word
like
for,
the different types of cloth, I just typically leave it in the Egyptian and say messes cloth instead of trying to pick what the English equivalent would be.
Or na'a cloth,
Yeah,
I
nah,
mean,
smooth. Like, what's that mean?
what does it mean? What are
Yeah.
these things? And so, and I have to deal with it for coffins, which is the outer coffin, which is the inner coffin, which is the mummy board, which is the mask. And when the styles of object are changing, then the lexicography changes. And sometimes a word that meant something in the Middle Kingdom, for example, would mean something different, same word, in the 18th dynasty. And so lexicography is fraught. If we have a problem with knowing what words mean what, I think it's our problem, not the Egyptians' problem. I would go with, and this is a gut answer that I'm giving here, and you can of course follow up with the Egyptians knowing the different parts and being much more familiar with female anatomy. There's also no evidence for female genital mutilation in ancient Egypt. There is for male circumcision, we can call it, rather than calling it genital mutilation because it is less invasive, though I think some men would disagree. But female genital mutilation means that women probably today in Egypt have a better understanding of different anatomy parts, but that doesn't mean, yeah. So but not men, because the fact that you're mutilating and removing something means that you've changed it. You know, you're trying to change the anatomy from something that it is and should be to something that is perceived as cleaner and better, and sewing things up and moving things around. So we're even modifying our our anatomy today, or for the last 500
Well, and people are doing, you know, people are getting like labioplasties and things, modern Western culture to, you know, ascribe to a certain look that they're going for.
And where do people give birth? They give birth in hospitals in the United States and in most Western countries. And in the United States, you've got sometimes up to half of the births happening through C-section. And if you just carve somebody open and then take out their uterus and carve up the uterus and take the baby out, why do you need to know the other equipment? It's just, that's how babies are born, you know? And so even the way that we have industrialized, medicalized birth, so that it's not happening in the home, it's not something that you would see as a child, it's not something that you would see as a boy or man in the house. These are things that make it very confusing. And if you're not, like, seriously, if you, if your cow is giving birth and the cow is having trouble, you're going to stick your arm in there and you're going to find the cow's head and you're going to pull and you're going to know the damn parts of female anatomy. And then when you milk the cow, you're going to know.
That's what the analogy the to the breast.
Exactly. So only in a world where we have wrapped everything in plastic and smoothed it all over and gotten labioplasties, I think, would we ask, would men like not know?
And I think
these different parts.
Part of it is, which is what the book I read was fighting against, the idea of like menstrual, negative ideas about menstruation and having to hide it, right?
There's no evidence, that women had to go to a privacy tent or anything like that.
And like, there's those records from Daryl Medina where the men got like off from work when it appears the wives were menstruating to like help out. So I think this idea of it's something being in Western society where it's like, I could be menstruating right now, you don't even know. And it's something to be hidden and like shameful about. That's, I think, a very more recent development. So I think it just would have been more, you know,
I'm not going to say the Egyptians didn't have tampons. I'm sure that you could take a bundle of flax and create a tampon-like shape and work with something like that. I think it could work. I don't know how absorbent flax threads or unprocessed flax would be. And we don't have cotton yet, which is more absorbent. But like, I'm sure there's some sort of plants that, that were absorbent you could make like a tampon out of.
Free blood.
Or you just, you had the rags or you just dealt with it and you figured out a place to be where it was more comfortable. And it wasn't something you could really hide.
I was looking through the Daryl Medina textile stuff recently and there's always shipments of rags and typically they're understood to be for making wicks for the tombs, which like
for the lamps
to use in the tombs. But I was like in my head, what if they're also, I mean, for the, all the women in the village as well? Like, why can't it, you know, just rags can be, I mean, could be for cleaning, could be for so many other things too.
I followed some of this on social media at one point and people are like, oh, with mummification, the Egyptians knew everything about anatomy, but you, and this is true for things deep inside. So if we're talking about how the womb like kind of floats inside the body and how it's attached or not attached, how, you know, how that links up to the vaginal canal, how, there's fallopian tubes and ovaries, you know, the Egyptians would indeed have had more knowledge about those things, but that you don't need that to know that there are parts of the female genitalia that are, you know, they're on the outside of the living body, and people would have had more access and knowledge and talked about it more. And we can see just in something like the Turin erotic papyrus that there is indeed knowledge of a clitoris. There is indeed knowledge of different sexual parts and how this works. So
and there has been work with looking at the words that people use for like cot or something, I you know, has been, is a word I think equated to like vulva. And we can link some of those articles in the Substack notes for this if you're interested in really getting more in the weeds about it.
Yeah, and I'll leave that lexicography to other people with better understandings of the, where genitalia stops and starts
But there,
and other
there's
things.
a whole gynecological papyri that we have. So they knew, there was issues related to it, just like modern day issues, and people were attempting to solve it in their own way. So,
And I just put into my uh-oh the word vagina in the English to search for Egyptian, and you get things like it's pretty horrible. There's some euphemistic terms for vagina, and one of the most common ones is euf, which means meat. It's
Flesh.
pretty brutal, or flesh. Yes. And so there's euf, there's sepet, which means lips. So that would be more vulva type thing.
I
And
mean, the main like
septi,
wound
the two
one,
lips. Yeah.
like
Yeah,
being
that's
like
for a
a
wound as
vessel,
well. Yes. Cot, as you mentioned, with the ka arms and different determinatives, sometimes the flesh determinative, sometimes these two curly Qs, which might be like fallopian tubes, people might think. And let me search if there's a differentiation between vagina and vulva. Okay, interesting. They've got it backwards. So whoever's done this dictionary doesn't understand that the vulva is on the outside,
Maybe
the
it was a
vagina is on the
man.
inside. Maybe it was a man because they have here womb slash vulva, which is wrong, right? But the word, because it should be the two lips should be the vulva, whereas the vagina and womb have more of a connection. But we have idet for the womb. And it looks like little fallopian tubes attached to it, right? And then hemet, another word they have here, vulva, but I'm going to go with womb because it also is that little water basket or the,
But
little
that's
thing.
also the word for woman, right? Another word for,
Hemet,
So it's just
yeah,
like
just call
you're
us
a
what we
womb.
are. Hey, womb, get over here, womb. But yes, let's do a search for clitoris and see. Ah, nothing. We are not surprised.
I love the joke where they're like, oh, we didn't discover the clit until whatever the Renaissance, and it's like.
Oh, come
Like, I
on.
think people knew about it before then.
Give me a
I hope
break.
so, for their sake.
Yeah. And there's no fallopian tubes, nor should we expect them. Let's look for ovaries. Oh no ovaries. And it's quite possible these words exist in medical texts, but we haven't
We
been
just
able to
don't
identify
know.
them. And this is, I am using a lower standard dictionary. So there are better dictionaries out there, and I'm sure there are people having these discussions, but it
But
is not me. It
very
is not
interesting
I.
question.
Yeah, yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
I think your point about being more intimately related with like animal reproduction, people would have had a much clearer, idea of how babies were made and all that
Yeah,
good
yeah.
stuff.
And children would never have had to ask. This is not something that there's no
They didn't
moment
just
of
have like
sitting your
sex
kid
ed.
down. No sex ed. There's no sitting your kid down and saying, "Now, dear Johnny, let me
Birds
tell
and the
you how it
bees.
happens." No, this would have been, there is the notion of privacy would have been a very different one for the ancient world than it is today. Yeah. Particularly for sexuality.
Great question. Thanks, Matt. Okay. Pivoting, Noir88 asks, when I was in the Egyptian Museum in München, I noticed a child's sarcophagus covered with some spells of the Book of the Dead. I was wondering, do we have any evidence or do you know if children had to go through the same hurdles as adults to reach the afterlife? Did they undergo the weighing of the heart? Did they have to cross the different gates protected by the gate guardians? I compare the Christian belief to the Christian belief, and as far as I remember, as a baby or child would automatically go to heaven as long as they're baptized. If they're not baptized, they go to purgatory. Another thing I was wondering is if different spells were used for kids. So, like, was there a difference between afterlife rituals for children versus adults?
There's so much one could do on this question. It's such a good question. Who's asking?
Noir88.
Oh, Noir 88. Such a good question. So, and Jordan, I know you know all of this as well and can add to it. But there is a difference. There are basic differences between adult burials, preparation for death and burial, and children preparation for death and burial, or containment within death and burial. So the first thing is we can say there are very few child coffins. This is not a normal, a coffin is not something that you prepare for somebody who has not entered society as a functional individual who is mm-hmm. who is giving to society. I have seen child coffins that belong to extraordinary members of society as children. So like a king's son would have a child coffin. And some of those were found in the royal cache, Diyarbakir 320, for instance, or other West Theban caches. There is a child's, there are two child's coffins for girls that I can think of off the top of my head for the 19th, 20th dynasty. And one is in the Louvre from Deir el-Medina, and the other is in the National Museums of Scotland. And I can't remember the name for either one of those, but the names of the girls. But it's important to then think of how girls reach maturity faster, even with a smaller body, get their period earlier, can then become what we would call a functional individual. They can give birth, they can be someone who is part of adult society, even at the age of maybe 9, 10, or 11. And these coffins do belong to smaller people. And so that's, I'm not going to say that it's more common to have a girl's coffin than a boy's coffin, because the boy's coffins, I'm thinking of three princes' coffins mm-hmm. versus a couple of girls' coffins. But it does seem that in a non-royal setting, it is more common that a girl be considered a functional individual even before earlier. Adulthood.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm showing you the
coffin here that the image is linked. So you can see it, but it's an unusual.
Where is this one?
In München.
Oh, that's in München. Okay. Yeah. It's early 18th dynasty, maybe, or I'm sorry, early 19th dynasty. What is the date for this?
I don't know if they provided that.
It's a yellow coffin, but a very unusual shrine-like type, old-fashioned shrine-like type of coffin.
I was going to say, yeah, the shape is interesting, and just the decoration on the side.
Right, and you've got mourning happening, mm-hmm. Offerings to the deceased. It looks like an outer coffin. So this looks like the kind of outer sarcophagus you have in the tombs of Senegem. In the tomb of Senegem.
Like the sled.
Just like for Senegem mm-hmm. and Ha. And, you know, I haven't looked at this piece, and I probably should have. This is a deficit. I'm feeling guilty now, because anytime I see a coffin I should have looked at, I'm like, God damn it, that should go into my work as well. But yeah, it looks just like the Ha and Senegem pieces. So I would say this is a wooden sarcophagus rather than mm-hmm. a coffin.
Not a coffin. Yeah.
And the coffin or mummy is depicted on the side of this sarcophagus mm-hmm. in which they're giving offerings to the deceased. So it's a super interesting piece. But the short answer to the question is that if you had a child, and that child could be stillborn to 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age, most children were buried under the floors of homes and kept within the domestic sphere and not sent out into the perilous world of the afterlife with all of those gates and those quizzes by the different demons and all of those trials and travails. At least that's what I think. I don't have a text that says we don't send children into these parts of the afterlife. We keep them in the home. But it seems to me that's what the Egyptians are doing, that these are not, you can somehow keep them in the space of the living and keep them safe. Mm-hmm. And then we have to also know that the Nile would have flooded over most villages, right? And these children's burials mm-hmm. would have been flooded and been a part of the Nile's inundation waters. And I have to then believe that this is part of why the Egyptians thought it was sometimes good luck to drown in the Nile and to go directly into this source of new life. So there's so much more work that one can do on this, but just know that unless a house is preserved in the desert, which is very, very rare, or the Nile is moved shortly after houses were established in a particular place, there's really no way to establish how children were buried unless you have a children's graveyard. There are some at Deir el-Medina. You could talk about them. That's a village in the desert. But it's really hard to, you can't dig these houses up. They're under meters of alluvial silt. Mm-hmm. They are gone, and you would have to pump and pump, and then good luck finding anything in all of that wet morass.
Yeah, that mudberg would be gone.
It would be gone. And but from the Deir el-Medina tombs, we have evidence that children were buried in pottery vessels, sometimes palm rib mats. But they are kept in a different sphere, closer to the ancestors, because we know there were ancestors' busts in the home, but closer to the home. And I like to think not sent into that scary place, but who knows how people talked about these things and how they envisioned it themselves.
Like who went to the afterlife? I mean, that's obviously a big debate too. I think we often like equate it with like the Judeo-Christian Islamic heaven hell dichotomy, but you know.
I mean, yes, I can go with this. And in fact, I have stated more than once that I think the ancient Egyptians invented hell, or at least they were the first to visualize it, the first to describe what they thought hell realms would be. It's not as clearly clear cut between a heaven and hell in a Judeo-Christian Islamic perspective. And the Judeo is, we'd have to take that out, I guess.
Yeah,
the Christian I guess,
yeah,
Islamic.
They don't have it. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, and they show people roasting alive. They show people without their heads. They show people upside down. They show people with no shadow who are just in darkness. They show really awful stuff, just as awful as what you would see in Michelangelo's image of hell, you know, where people are getting pulled out of their skin or Dante's descriptions. Exactly. But I like, and everyone would have had those trials and tribulations of going through those different gates. How much knowledge you got about it, that is a different story. So how much of a cheat sheet you're able to bring with you into death would depend upon your socioeconomic status and your ability to pay and bring disposable income with you into the tomb in the form of a papyrus with the Book of the Dead, or even an amduat with the different hours of night or whatever. But I think children, you would lay in the bosom of their ancestors. And given that we know that ancient Egyptians had ancestor busts and considered the ancestors the Ahu, those who are effective, who have made it past the trials and tribulations of these gates and are on the bark of millions and are part of this world of effective dead, they would be the ones to whom you would entrust your dead children. And there would have been a lot of dead children.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I think that's what we did consider too, is that it would have been common, sadly. So I'm sure there was a prescribed way of dealing with it. But yeah, I think your point that if they have a coffin or a sarcophagus, they're well to do, and most of the ones we have are like royal children, right?
Right.
Think of Tuts or something like this. Yeah,
right.
But it's a very interesting little piece, Jen.
It's a really cool coffin or sarcophagus, and I need to take a closer look at it.
Gotta go to Germany.
I do.
Okay, pivoting a bit, but still talking about women, so I feel like we have maybe a little theme here. Karen asks that they recently heard an interview with classicist Shelley Haley, who I think most of us probably know, where she claimed that the reason ancient Egyptian women had paler skin than men in tomb paintings is because women are affiliated with the sky and men with the earth, the Nut-Geb dichotomy. I hadn't heard this before, and she didn't offer any evidence to back up the claim. Is there any validity to this? Does it make sense? What do you think?
I hadn't heard that before. And I don't
either,
think,
but
yeah, and I haven't seen that in any texts. But she's right that we are talking about Nut, the sky goddess, and Geb, the earth god, and the earth is darker than the sky. So that's completely possible. There's so much discussion about this. And you know, the Egyptians are not monolithic about it. They change with styles. And the time period that I spend a lot of my time studying, the Ramesside period, 19th and 20th dynasties, it's super common to show a woman with red skin, dark red ochre skin, like a sunburnt, darker person, not a natural brown.
Yeah.
Coffins are not a place for naturalistic skin tones. Like, one thing we could put in the show notes is the image of Tutankhamun's head coming out of the lotus blossom, which I think is a wonderful, the one I always go to. That's, or the mannequin, right? The mannequin is a wonderful naturalistic skin tone that gives you an idea of what a person from Thebes, from modern day Luxor, but Thebes as was, what color their skin would likely have been, how dark it would have been. As I always say, if they were in Alabama in 1954, they would have sat at the back of the bus. But if that's a naturalistic skin tone, the coffin is not going to show that. So this dark red color, I have argued, has a different meaning, that it's showing that the women who are dying are associating themselves with the sun god for their own rebirth. And I've made the argument that they are thus masculinizing to do this because the solar element is masculine, and always is, if whether it's Ra or the Aten disc or globe, or whether it's Re Harakhti, and that masculine element is where resurrection comes from. The sun god can recreate himself as the bull of his mother. And so you have people making coffins, working with that, and then masculinizing women so they can have their own rebirth in the same way. Now, I mean, do you have anything to add to that? What do you think?
Like the idea that like men with the earth, like I can kind of see that, but then like Newt, you know, when we have depictions of Newt, I wouldn't say like the sky is associated with any like colors in particular.
And then
And like,
there's
is it
also
like the night sky, like Milky Way, like,
And then there's
but
Ahmes Nefertari.
who
Ahmes
has
Nefertari has dark
like
black
Kemet, yeah.
skin. Yes. And is associated ostensibly with the rich earth that is deposited. And so there we have a female element associated with a Geb-like element. We think, though, Ahmes Nefertari's skin is never explained. Is that a night sky? We don't know, because a night sky would be black. So, or a deep blue. And so, well, as for the yellow ochre for women and the red ochre for men, my and most Egyptologists' quick explanation for this is to say that it's that we have two things going on. One, you have a patriarchal society that encourages men to be out active and women to be more domestic, and thus women are in the home more often. But there's a second element, which is wealthier women who are not by the riverside washing the clothes or helping with the harvest out in the fields, helping with threshing as a young girl or whatever. They're in the home a lot more. And then when you have that kind of civilizational effect, women would have then competed with each other within upper echelons of society for a lighter skin to show that they were working less. And that's something that we still see today with, with attempts to have lighter skin, particularly in places like Japan and Korea, Mexico, South America, less so in Europe and among white women in
I
Europe.
feel like it's coming back though, honestly, even
Maybe,
amongst
yeah.
like what like European American, just because of people's consciousness about skincare and like aging. People don't want to look old, so they're like, well, I need to be like really conscious on my skincare, so therefore being paler equates like I'm not in the sun damaging my skin. I feel like there's this side trend of like, being paler is in again, where being tan for the longest time was like that was the ideal. But
And yeah, and so go with socioeconomics, go with patriarchal, gender-based work divisions, and I think you get an idea of why the skin colors would be different. But it's,
But the Newt Geb, I think, just speaks to the messiness of Egyptian religion, where maybe, like, I'm not saying that's not right. It might not be a part of it. Or if you said that to an Egyptian, they might be like, yeah, man or of the earth, Geb, dark.
Because when you do look at a day book of day and night in a tomb like Ramses the Sixth, you would see her skin is yellow. It is a yellow or ochre in that case, plus orpiment. It probably had a lot of orpiment in it because it's a royal tomb, so they're going to use the expensive pigment. But and it's not red. The sun is red. So from that perspective, she's right. The sun is that dark red ochre plus realgar. And the newt body is a yellow plus orpiment. So yeah, there's something to it. There's something to it.
The Egyptian religion, I'm always like, could be. Sure. Like it doesn't, you know. Okay. So, kind of pivoting back to what we started with, about your recent trip to RC and the conference and all these things. One of our listeners was actually there, which is super great. Shout out to Josh. And Josh was able to attend your talk there. And he has a question, a follow-up question, so we can get into that. But I think before we introduce the question, can you give us a brief summary of what your presentation was on, what your argument was, so the question
Yeah.
makes sense maybe to other listeners?
And I got to meet Josh at RC, which was great. So, hey, Josh, now you're famous on the podcast, and I hope your jujitsu is going well. And that's awesome. So, my paper was about Bronze Age collapse, however you want to define it. And some people hate the word collapse. They're like, nothing collapsed and it all kept going. And they would be right, but that's also part of collapse studies, and some things collapse and other things don't. You create
Collapse and
workarounds.
resilience, yeah.
Exactly. And it was about elites and how much elites need the king and how much kings need elites, and how kingship, as you move from dynasty 20 to 21, was a very fraught thing. And that you have men like Pai Yonk and Harry Hoare, who start out as generals in a military community of practice, and then move into a high priesthood and then become king. At least H Harry Hoare does, and Panmunjom after him does as well, at least in some context. But the kingship is kind of problematic. You don't want to become too much of a king at this time period when the baggage of kingship is so heavy, because the Ramessids seem to have abused it, or at least there is a perception in Thebes of the Ramessids having abused kingship. And so there is a purposeful distancing from the kingship that Harry Hoare certainly takes, because his throne name is High Priest of Amun, which is awesome. Inside of the cartouche, it says High Priest of Amun in Egyptian. And so people have looked at this and they're like, well, clearly he's not a king, because he inside the cartouche, he says he's High Priest of Amun. And then I make the argument that, well, he is a king, but he needs to have his cake and eat it too. He can't be all king, because then the elites will get super pissy. He has to kind of be first among equals, in this Caesar Augustus sort of system, this princeps system invented by Octavian. I think it's a good comparison that at some points kingship is so distrusted as an institution that you have to keep, you put a finger, you touch it, and
Got to
then you
drain
kind
the
of back
swamp.
away. Yeah, a little bit, a little bit. And so there were discussions of how people were working with kingship, and also how, so that was one element. And then the other element of the talk was how these same men, Pai Yonk, Hari Hoare, Panmunjom the First and Second, were using ancestor kings like Amenhotep the First and Thutmose the Third, and their wives, Ahmes Nefertari, Teti Sheri, women like that, how they were using them as talisman, protective talisman, body and all, to protect their regimes, to justify their regimes, and how they set themselves up as the caretakers of these kings. And while we know, because people like Nicholas Reeves and John Taylor and Carl Jansen Winkeln have already proved, circumstantially, but sometimes directly, that the High Priests of Amun in the 20th and 21st dynasties were systematically going through the tombs in the Valley of the Kings and recommodifying to support their regimes economically. We know that that was happening. The same men that were systematically going to the tomb of Ramses II were pulling out his body after they took off all the jewels and all the amulets and all the other things. You can imagine what Tutankhamun had. It would have been like 10 times better than rewrapping them and saying, we're the only ones that can fix this. It's a very typical problem, a typical authoritarian means of taking control, to create a problem or step into a problem that you can't stop, participate in that problem, and then say, but I'm the only one who can fix this. And that's exactly what we have at this time period. So they're saying, these bodies, they're in peril. They're not protected. We're going to do it. And they show their people how they protected the body of Amenhotep the First, how they protected the body of Thutmose the Third. And indeed, we do have evidence that they've rewrapped them. over multiple occasions, not just one time, but they would take the body out, take off most of the amulets, leave some on and rewrap it, and then put the body in with a mummy mask. And then a generation later, they'd be like, oh, there's still good shit in there. Let's open it up again and take out all those amulets and rewrap it again and take the mummy mask this time because it's made of gold and we need that. And then, you know, put the body back with magical spells attached, spells of protection to connect to that body and to make the angry dead not rise up, blah, 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 blah. But to present themselves in that way, they are presenting themselves as the heirs of the 18th, 19th, and 20th dynasty kings. Mm-hmm. And they choose specific kings to associate with. So in the same way that Harry Hoare is like, I'm a king, but not too much. You have him going, I'm a king, but not too much. And the kings I want to connect with are the cool kings that didn't abuse you. Kings like Amenhotep I or Thutmose III or even Ramses II. We have no memory of abuse with these kings, right? These are the good kings. Mm-hmm. To give a shout out to my book. And and since these are the good kings, we are the good inheritors and heirs of these good kings. And because we have reburied them, we inherit everything. And there is actually a law that we have preserved from a papyrus called Papyrus mm-hmm. Bulak 10, which we can put in the show notes, that says that the one who buries inherits. And it seems the high priests are using this as a mechanism of getting their justification for being the next rulers, even though they're Libyan warlords. Important point to make. These guys are in no way connected to the Ramessid lineage before them. They are immigrants. They are coming from a military community of practice, which allows a whole lot of social mobility. So they have a whole lot of justification to do over many generations. Yeah.
And yeah, so you, this is talked about even more in depth in episode 83 about T3, Thutmose III, and the veneration of the royal ancestors. So if you want to dive in more to this, please see that episode. Having said that, so Josh was at your presentation and says, Kara used Harry Hoare and Panegyum the First depictions from Khonsu Temple. So we know Josh has worked on Khonsu Temple stuff for their thesis. And your presentation was entitled Elites Relying on Cultural Memory for Regime Building. And Josh says, I fully agree with the stance that elites tend to draw on past established accepted norms to justify their reigns. This is evident in one in particular way to me, best as the story of Alexander's father being Nectanebo, right? You're trying to connect yourself with the to help legitimize regime, right to rule. My question is not to counter the proposed argument, but to ask for consideration that they looked at further in their work, that the depictions in Khonsu Temple are more about the king's association with Khonsu, effectively his brother and elder brother that grants kingship to the king. This would put any correlation with Khonsu as a matter of necessity of sorts due to religious implications and less about cultural memory. Or yeah. Is that even worth a differentiation?
I think both things can be true at the same time. Is there more to the question?
I understand that all of the depictions in Khonsu are about kings, as Kara used, though Kitchen does discuss Panegyum, the first does become king, unlike that of Harry Hoare. But yeah, so looking at, does the Khonsu Temple depiction say more about establishing godly currency and justification versus cultural memory, or is that not a distinction that should even be made here?
I would say both things are true at the same time, that you can have the cultural memory of a different kind of kingship while creating a new kind of kingship. And the memory of the old, dare I say, abusive kind of kingship, a kingship that is perceived as too much, mm-hmm. taking too much, is there haunting the entire discussion. So they're going back to a kingship story, mythology, that has a purity associated with it. So Khonsu is there in a way to wipe the slate clean and create a new cultural memory. So I would agree with that. And the Khonsu being the offspring of Mut and Amun-Re, or Mut and Amun, is perfect because it is about the inheritance. It is about the heir. And I didn't talk about that aspect of it. So Josh is completely right. I also, at the RC talk, was listening to the talk by Nicholas Warner, who's doing conservation in the Khonsu Temple. And he pointed out, and I hadn't heard this before, but I just loved it, that this is the only known purpose-built temple out of entirely reused materials. Because every block they find, it seems, is reused. Huh. They're able to examine in a closer way. The foundations are reused. The blocks are reused. Everything there is reused. And this is starting in the Ramessid period and moving forward. And that's so very interesting. And so there's, you know, there's another thing that I didn't discuss in my talk either, which is how these men, Heri Hor, Panejim the First, Payank, before both of them, how they use links to the Ramessid family at the same time. So they're both married to Ramessid princesses, and maybe even the same one, right? Payank and Heri Hor both have a wife named Nojmet. And Nojmet, from what we can tell from other information, papyri found in Theban tomb 320, coffins, other things, seems to have been a Ramessid king's daughter. And her sister, Tanet Amun, was married to another Libyan warlord up north in Tanis. And that's Nessie Ben Ebjed. And so you've got these princesses who are being used probably with their full knowledge and ability coming to the fore. These women, these were strong women who were ruling in their husband's absence when they were away at war, but they're being used as physical connectors to the regime lineage that existed before. Mm-hmm. So even though you've got somebody like Heri Hor, who creates a whole kingship mythology with the royal sons and daughters like Ramses II would have done in Khonsu Temple, he still calls himself high priest in his initiated throne name that he has given upon his ascension. And yet at the same time, he's doing things very old school in that he's like, yeah, but I need a lineage. My children need to be king's grandsons. Mm-hmm. And I need king's great grandsons. And that lineage then populates Tanis and populates the Theban high priesthood, even after kingship in Thebes, at least, is no longer accepted. Is more problematic. And a high priest is as far as people want to go. There's no more of this kingship, playing around with kingship. Panejim II, for instance, is quite happy to just be a high priest, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But they're doing all kinds of different things. And someday I will write more about these things.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel like people always forget about the women, and
yeah,
you know, like,
yeah,
they were the connection back to the old regime.
Yeah. And we forget the women because they're pushed to the side, mm-hmm. purposefully by the patriarchal regime, and they are just the connectors. They are the bodies through which the seed of the men go, and thus we push them aside. But in this case, in this moment of great military, economic, social upheaval, those women's bodies were a linchpin for the warlords who were able to rise to the top and marry them. Mm-hmm. And they became king, these two men, or they gained power almost certainly after they had married these Ramessid women. So I don't think they married these women and were like, okay, now I'm going to use her to become king. I think the king needed the connections to these warlords and thus married his daughters to them, which in and of itself is pretty
very
amazing.
Un-Egyptian, yeah.
Right. For the Ramessid period, we know that daughters were married out. For the 18th, yeah. There's no evidence of it. But for the 19th and 20th, we've got evidence of it. But then for these men to use those marriages and vault themselves into the kingship, or for their women to help them do it, I'm sure that women like Nojmet and Tanet Amun helped their men to find
be
their
such
way
a good
through.
TV show.
I know. I know.
Such a good TV show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
such good court machinations and stuff going
mm-hmm.
on there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to make an executive decision. We have some more questions, but I think we're at a good time limit, and I don't like doing too long of episodes. So any extra questions that we have for this month, I'm gonna push to May. So if your question didn't
Okay.
get answered, I have it here. It will be moving to our May document. So don't worry, we will answer it. But thank you for all the great questions that we got in. They were all really interesting. You guys always amaze me with your questions and things I never thought of. Okay. But thank you all. Thank you, Kara.
Thank you.
This is.
Afterlives of Ancient Egypt. Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack Ancient Now at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for @Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.